I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the World Cricket Show, the world's favourite cricket show, with me, Adam Bayfield, and joining me on the telephone, it's only the same guy who always joins me on these things, Tony Kerr.
Yeah, all suspense is just long dead and buried.
How's it going, Tony?
Yeah, it's alright, thanks. Yeah,
we're back doing a remote record, which is the first one of these for a while. We've had our fair share of technical hitches getting this up and running.
Well, that's it. I mean, yeah, regular listeners will know that we have sort of, certainly for quite a few months, we're fortunate enough to dodge the pandemic more or less from here in Guernsey. I'm sure you'll explain a bit, but we've had a bit of a relapse, so we're back in the game. So
to speak. We've had a rude awakening. After, well, as you say, quite a few months since sort of beginning of last summer, we had essentially normality here in Guernsey with no restrictions, but lockdown's back after a few unexplained cases a couple of weeks ago. So,
we're going to talk about cricket, aren't we? That's what we're here to do. And it's, you know, it's markedly different to lockdown one in that there's just so much great cricket at the moment. Whereas obviously the sort of first time around for us, it was very much the that period of uncertainty, sort of when will it ever come back. So yeah, it's actually quite a different experience so far.
It has been, as you say, it has been different in that way compared to our first lockdown. But otherwise, very similar, really. Tony and I have been busy. I've been doing all the traditional lockdown things. I've been making sourdough. I've been watching Tiger King. I've been doing keepy uppies with the toilet roll. I've been talking to you on House Party.
Yeah, true. Really rolling back the months.
I don't know whether lockdown humour goes over very well at this point. I feel like most people on the mainland have probably lost their sense of humour about lockdown at this stage. So perhaps we should move on quickly. But on one of those House Party calls, you were saying to me, Tane, that you are appreciating the opportunity to watch a lot of the cricket that's on. And you said cricket's on fire at the moment. And I think you're right about that. We've got lots to talk about tonight. Starting with a remarkable result in the first test between India and England. And it doesn't stop there. We've also got an extraordinary record-breaking test match between Bangladesh and West Indies in Chittagong to talk about, and Pakistan v South Africa in Rawalpindi. So, I mean, arguably too much, Tone. Are we going to get through it all?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, yeah, I'm sure you'll come at me with more questions imminently. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's tough to remember, and I've not got the best memory going, but it's tough to remember a kind of more enjoyable probably month of test cricket or 6 weeks of cricket kind of in general, for just so many different reasons, like so much variety, so many great storylines, some brilliant performances. It's golden days for cricket.
It's got it all. Well, and Channel 4 as well, free-to-air TV in the UK. But we're going to talk about all of that. Let's get stuck into it. I'm finding it a little difficult to take you seriously, Tone, I have to say. I can obviously see you on my screen here. Firstly, because you're in what I think is like your little box room, your shoebox room in your flat. Not really a spare room, not big enough to have a bed in it. So it's sort of a large walk-in closet anyway. But on the wall behind you, there's a picture of sort of charcoal drawings of naked women.
Yeah, not the product of my lockdown boredom, but some rather sophisticated artwork, you might say.
Well, it is, but it's sort of, it would be quite a bold background if you were on a work Zoom call or on like BBC Breakfast if you're on TV, which is kind of what it looks like to me. But also you're wearing quite sort of big wraparound headphones, which looks like you kind of look like a cross between a footballer rocking up on a Saturday for a game and an airline pilot bringing a plane into land.
Well, yeah, I had to sort of dance around that artwork. So I was based out of here in lockdown one, doing a few video kind of recordings, video interviews with people in the Channel Islands sports sphere. It was quite a difficult room to work in because it was sort of my sort of boxer shorts strewn over one side. kind of semi-racy artwork over the other side. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you could always just take it off the wall.
It's an option.
It's just for the duration of the pandemic. And maybe put your boxer shorts in the wash. All right, well, let's move on from there and talk about some cricket, Tone. And let's start in Chennai. And the first test in a 4-test series between India and England. India, of course, fresh from their historic series victory in Australia, taking on an England side that got smashed 4-0. The last time they were in India in 2016. And it was a pretty remarkable game. England winning the toss, batted first, and racked up a mammoth 578 in their first innings, thanks in huge part to Joe Root continuing his blistering form at the start of this year. He made 218, a couple of 80s as well, one from Don Sibley and one from Ben Stokes. India, in reply, were bowled out for 337, with Dom Best taking 4 for 76. So they were a long way behind on the first innings. England could have made them follow on, but opted to bat again. On the fourth day, they made it to 178 from 46 overs, just trying to move the game along and set up a fourth innings run chase. There was some chat about whether they delayed the declaration. They obviously didn't declare in the end, but whether they could have perhaps declared at some point a bit earlier. That was very much the conversation after the fourth day, but it became a moot point on the fifth day because they bowled India out in 58 overs for just 192. Some resistance from Virat Kohli with 72, but otherwise not much from India, as Jack Leach took 4 wickets and Jimmy Anderson 3 for 17, including the wickets of Shubman Gill and Ajinkya Rahane in one quite extraordinary over. To wrap up, a huge victory for England by 227 runs to continue their winning streak away from home. What is that now? Six test victories in a row away from home. So, I mean, this game, Tone, played out very much as we expected. It was extremely one-sided, big margin of victory, one team in total command and the other falling in a bit of a heap. But the thing is, it was the wrong way around. It was topsy-turvy to what we expected. It's England who've won by a huge margin. So I don't think either of us saw this coming, but can you put it in a bit of perspective for us, Tone? A lot of people are saying this might be one of England's greatest victories of all time. Is it? Do you go along with that? How good a win is this?
You don't want to play it down. I think it's certainly fair to say it's one of England's in living memory, England's greatest away performances. I think there's probably an argument as to whether, you know, in terms of spectacles and victories and drama, and obviously it kind of wasn't really there. It was pretty. It was so convincing that can you compare it to say or can you yeah? It's not quite on the same level as say Karachi. But you're going back 20 years for that, you know. It's probably not quite on the same level for me as England's Ashes triumph 10 years ago. A couple of the results in there, but it's clearly the best since then by a country mile, and it's got to be one of England's best and most complete performances for sure.
Yeah, it's. I suppose the thing is, yeah. My question was: is it one of England's greatest wins of all time? And that's the chat. Is it one of England's greatest wins of all time? And I mean, it's a great hedge, isn't it? One of in the end. I do this all the time, you know, both talking about cricket on the podcast and just with other things generally in life. That's one of the best meals I've ever had. That's one of the best films I've ever seen. One of how many? You know, it's like what? Yeah. Does that mean one of the two or three best or one of the 250 best? Yeah, I think you're right. It's certainly the most recent England victory away from home. I mean, I think it's up there, if only by virtue... Yeah, firstly, as you say, the performance. If only by virtue of its improbability. You know, it's up against... They were up against a team that has only lost one test at home in the last 8 years, and won something, won 30 plus in that time. And they were coming into this, as I say, on fire after winning in Australia. But it's also, as you point out, it's the performance. It's because this wasn't a fluke or something you can explain away or say they got a bit lucky or even that it was close and they just edged it. They absolutely crushed India here. And it was a complete team performance. So whether it is, quote unquote, one of their best wins of all time is perhaps debatable. As you say, there are other examples that spring to mind, like the win in Australia 10 years ago. Even the win in India in 2012, you know, has very quickly been forgotten about. But those two wins there in Mumbai and Kolkata were two of England's best performances, you know, away from home that I've ever seen.
I meant to mention.
So it's possibly a moot point. But I think it's, you know, if you want to rank it, I think it's certainly top 10 of this century, maybe top five. But it's, you know, bottom line, it's an incredibly impressive win and a very satisfying one as well for England fans.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to be a naysayer. I mean, there is so much to enjoy. Some phenomenal performances, as you say, kind of pretty much top to bottom. I suppose I'm always kind of put off or you know, turned off by people kind of lavishing too much praise too quickly on stuff. At the end of the day, it is the first test of a four-match series. England could end up losing 3-1, at which point is it, you know, which it almost becomes, yeah.
It would be undone somewhat.
Yeah, exactly. But that's also being a bit negative. Clearly, you know, England are 1-0 up in a series that's going to come thick and fast. You know, the confidence will be there. You know, who knows? The sky's the limit at this point. But certainly where it figures in the series, you know, there's a lot of work to do. But yeah, I'm not complaining.
Yeah, we should possibly, you know, withhold any kind of finality of judgment until the end of the series. Obviously, India got obliterated in the first test of the series in Australia and came back to win that. So there is a long way to go. But it wasn't just that England kind of snuck a win here or even just, you know, engineered a win. They, as I say, they absolutely tore India to shreds, really. You know, they were just so dominant. And it was a complete team performance, but there were some standout individual performances, largely from England's senior players. I mean, so shall we start with Jimmy Anderson? Because he's obviously sort of captured the headlines on the final day, producing a spell of 3 for 7 in 6 overs, including a truly extraordinary over where, as I mentioned, he removed Shubman Gill and Ajinkya Rahane with kind of heat-seeking in-swingers. I mean, that was quite some over, Tane. It's been compared already to Flintoff's over to Langer and Ponting in 2005. It was pretty remarkable stuff.
Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't see it live, I have to say.
Sleeping, snoozing.
Slept through
flat
that
out.
But yeah, certainly watching it back, I mean, just delicious deliveries that you couldn't ask much more from. Had everything aesthetically pleasing. Clearly kind of vital in the context, or certainly very important in the context, in terms of removing a set batsman and then one of India's kind of litany of stars. So it was phenomenal stuff, and the context of you know, Anderson and kind of where he is in his career and where he's still going. It's astonishing.
Yeah, well, arguably still getting better in some respects. I mean, talking about that or the comparisons to that Flintoff over again, I don't want to be negative or, you know, say to people, you know, that thing that you enjoyed today, it was rubbish. But yeah, like for me, it, you know, perhaps didn't quite have the magic of that Flintoff moment. A, because nothing ever will have the magic of 2005 for me personally, but also because England were so far ahead of the game here. As you say, it was a very important moment, but you still at that point thought that England were going to win. Whereas Flintoff in 2005, it really did change the game. It felt like the game was heading towards Australia at that point. It didn't really feel quite like that here. So didn't have quite the same context for me, but just in terms of the actual bowling, it's certainly not far off that or far off one of the best overs you'll ever see. I mean,
and also in the absence of a crowd as well, it's obviously as a moment, it changes the energy of it, obviously, comprehensively. But so it's difficult to compare, I think, with that Flintoff over, because for what the reasons you've just laid out, but also the spectacle of the scene.
And also Flintoff was bowling really fast, and that's something slightly different to what Anderson was. Anderson was doing something incredibly skillful, but Flintoff, that over had the kind of raw energy to it that perhaps this one didn't have. So, nothing like that will ever be replicated, but this is not far off in terms of as a sort of genius bit of bowling. I mean, I was astonished to discover today social media that some Indian fans still refer to Anderson as Clouderson, which isn't a great
nickname,
but whatever you want to call it, insult. But the idea being that he only bowls well when it's cloudy, that he's a home track bully or a green track bully, he can only do it in home conditions, which is just incredibly wrong. I mean, like 10 or 11 years ago maybe that was true, but that's a long time ago. It hasn't been true for a very long time. It's a bit like saying, Steve Smith, I don't really rate him, he's quite an average leg spinner. Going back 10 years to that England win in Australia that you've already mentioned, Anderson was an incredibly key performer there. When England won in India in 2012, Emma Stoney said after that series that Anderson was the difference between the teams. I mean, of course, he's still got a better record at home than he does away. Quite a significantly better record, but that's partly because he has such a good record at home. And it's also true of most cricketers that they have a better record at home than away. So he averages 23 with the ball at home, but still 31 away, which is not necessarily world-class, but it's still very respectable. And is also improving. And it also, like, that number doesn't reveal the kind of match-winning performances that are bound up there. So, yeah, it's just not true. And, he kind of reinforced that, underlined that again today.
Yeah, absolutely. And just what he's doing at the moment, even over the last few weeks, the figures he returned in Sri Lanka in terms of, it's not, obviously that wasn't against a classic Sri Lanka team, but just the economy rate, the role he's playing in the side at the moment still is... it's utterly remarkable. And, obviously there's a lot of chat over the weekend about Tom Brady in the NFL. What's he, 43? And obviously has now won 7 Super Bowls, and I'm no NFL expert, but that's pretty good, I guess. We're in that ballpark in terms of kind of influencing a sport beyond the time when you really should be.
Yeah.
In a kind of novelty way, but in a kind of center of the action kind of way, it's pretty insane.
Like Federer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there are certainly a few around, aren't there now? And clearly, we're living in a different era to previously in terms of how players are able to keep going at such a high level in various sports, and there are lots of reasons for that, but. Yeah, there aren't many around like James Anderson. They are still unique within their sports, these guys.
Women. There's obviously some sports where you can carry on longer, like golf, snooker. It kind of tickles me that I did watch quite a bit of the World Championship snooker last summer. And, it's still a lot of the same guys that were at the top when I was watching the World Championship snooker aged about 10. They've just been around forever. John Higgins and Mark Williams and Ronnie O'Sullivan were all playing snooker when I was watching it in like 1993. but obviously that's a very different kind of sport. Some people would say it's not even a sport to something more kind of kinetic like football or rugby or tennis or cricket. So he's kind of defying gravity, really, James Anderson. Isn't he? And another remarkable performance here. He wasn't actually the leading wicket taker in that innings, though. Jack Leach finished with 4 wickets. And I was really pleased for him because he got absolutely clattered by Rishabh Pant in the first innings. I think he was going along about 10 and over at one point. Was starting to get a bit uncomfortable almost, or a bit sort of worried for him. But he came back really well in the rest of that innings. And then in the second innings, as they picked up 4 wickets, bowled a terrific delivery to get rid of Rohit Sharma on the fourth evening, and he nabbed Pajara as well. So yeah, really, really pleased for Leach.
It's a sort of classic example of why, even as someone, well, speaking as someone who's slightly addicted to Twitter, like you are.
Yeah.
Like, this test match was the perfect example of why you really shouldn't follow any cricket chat on Twitter during a test match.
Yeah.
It's people saying one thing, like bashing people or praising, and then literally a few breaths later or a day later, they're like, wow, great response to the critics there. It's just like, God's sake, just let the bloody match play out. Like,
yeah, I know. I've massively gone off Twitter. I mean, I still am addicted to it, but I don't actually know what I want anymore. It's the same with all social media, really. I think I've said this to you before, but I don't know what I want out of my Facebook newsfeed, because absolutely everything annoys me. Everything that everyone posts is annoying.
I don't know, if you just watched the match and enjoyed it and then made your comments at the end.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, just everyone's kind of like, everyone's sort of pitching for the best, like, pithiest, kookiest or funniest or whatever, you know. You can just sort of see everyone like crafting their tweet, and I've been guilty of that as well in the past, and I don't want to do it anymore. So follow us on Twitter at Cricket Show and you'll get like one tweet a month announcing a new episode.
Well, that's it. I mean, I just can't compete with that, so I don't bother, you know. Well, I'm not ready for the fight.
Anyway, clearly there was only one candidate, though, for man of the match. I assume he was man of the match. I should probably check that. Yes. And that was Joe Root with that magnificent double hundred. He's such a fantastic player of spin, Tone, isn't he? And it's great to watch. And he makes it look so easy with those kind of sweeps and paddles and just using his feet. It's very enjoyable to watch, certainly as an England fan. He now has 684 runs in 2021, and it's the 9th of February. So he only needs to average around 30 for the remainder of the year, and he would break Mohammad Yusuf's record for most runs in a calendar year. Mohammad Yusuf, in 2006, scored 1,788 runs. And so Root is very much on track for that. As I say, would not even need to do very much for the rest of the year. And we'll break that, obviously, partly because England are playing so many tests this year. But it does underline what an extraordinary start he has made to the year. Two double hundreds and another big hundred as well. It was a great inning. I mean, I don't know if you want to chip in at this point on the innings, but something that, again, I kind of saw on Twitter, but also was talked about in the commentary box, was this idea that, like, Root has sort of proved the point, or that, you know, it's like the sort of critics of Root need to have been sort of put in their place. I don't know, do you know what I mean? There's sort of an idea that it's like, oh, well, he's reminded everyone that actually he is a great player. But, like, I don't think anyone ever forgot that he was a great player, but it wasn't untrue to say that he was going through a dip in form. So from 2018 through 2020, he averaged 39 in Test cricket in 33 matches. I mean, that's a third of his Test career. He was averaging 39. So he had lost his way a little bit. And he still does have that conversion problem. You know, this was his 20th Test 100, and he's got, 49-50. So it really does leap out at you, especially compared to his sort of contemporaries, or the guys who should be his contemporaries in Cody Smith and Williamson. So, I don't think that it was wrong to say that he was, you know, struggling a little bit. It's not that he sort of proved people wrong here, but it is just fantastic to see him come back and perform this well over these three matches, because he is, when he plays like that, he's unstoppable. He's one of the absolute best players in the world.
But yeah, there's no doubt that he had dropped off somewhat from what was a pretty high level, obviously. A level that put him amongst the best in the world, at a time, or over the last few years, when those little batch of players at the very top of the Test batting standings, you know, they'll be considered amongst the best players of all time. Yeah, he had dropped off slightly. He was going through a bit of a lean spell, and that's obviously not the case right now, which is just wonderful to see. I don't think, no one's more pleased to see him scoring these runs than me.
Maybe himself, his parents.
Exactly. It was just awesome to see. And I agree with what you just said. I think as well, like, and it's another, I'll gloss over it quickly, but another social media issue. It's just this, like, you know, people saying, like, we're witnessing greatness.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, well, yeah, it's an absolutely phenomenal innings, but once again, you know, he scored a bunch of a big stack of runs in Sri Lanka against a mediocre Sri Lanka side, not taking anything or too much away from that, and he's done it again here, which is absolutely phenomenal. But yeah, I don't think he needs that. I don't think anyone needs the kind of the, you know, everyone to appoint him like an all time great right now.
Well, yeah, and also as brilliant as they've been, it is three innings. As you say, it's not to take anything away from him at all, but everyone could just maybe take a breath and absolutely enjoy it. But we don't need to rush to declare him the GOAT because he isn't. But, you know, at least not yet. He certainly needs to maintain this form for a longer period if he is going to go down with, you know, going to go down alongside your Smiths and your Williamsons. Yeah, he's certainly made a good start to the year, and it's really pleasing to see. No one is more pleased than the two of us.
And you know as well, like obviously he's a great age. You know, he's just turned 30, so you know the next few years obviously should be his peak years in terms of knowing his game, knowing the game of cricket, experience, everything. But also, what's wonderful as well is that. Yeah, it is quite an exciting time for England generally as a test team. You know, we've for a few years have been, well, it's been sort of two steps forward, one and a half steps back, and it's been a bit all over the place. But there is just this kind of, there's a seed of a, or more than a seed now, there's a little bush developing.
A little sapling.
Of a really good team. And, you know, for him now leading this team very well, his form is improving. It's possibly still early days. There's three tests to go in India. There's the Ashes down under to come this year. It could be an absolutely enormous year for him in England.
Yeah, it definitely is. It does have the makings of a good team, and it's a team I want to get behind. And one of the reasons I like it is because it's a sort of logical team. It feels like a logical team to me. It feels like they've actually picked some openers he want to dig in and bat long rather than, you know, Jason Roy and trying to bat Moeen Ali at three or whatever. Like, it just feels like a proper test team, and I like that. And as you say, it is his team, and there's no doubt that his captaincy has improved and he's really grown into it over the last couple of years, for all that his batting was dipping. And he had a really good game here as a captain, I think. I mean, so I mentioned this earlier, but there was a lot of talk on that fourth day about England delaying the declaration, or the fact they didn't declare. Certainly earned some scorn from Warne and Vaughan. They might have been wrong about that, Warne and Vaughan, given that England did go on to win. This comes up again and again and again, doesn't it? It was one of the real kind of bugbears for Ian Botham, this idea that England didn't beat the West Indies in Antigua in 2009 because Strauss delayed the declaration too long and West Indies finished 9 down. And ever since then, every time they're in this situation, it gets referenced. Or, you know, they always leave it too long. Like, they could have been right this time. It could well have been that Root misjudged it and that India did, you know, it might have happened that India batted all day on the fifth day and finished 7 wickets down or something, and England would have thought, if only we'd declared 10 overs earlier. But I do just wish that the commentators would at least allow for the fact that, like, it is a difficult decision and there is a reason to keep on batting. You know, if you take the time out of the game, which England did, and remove any chance of India winning, that does make a difference psychologically to both teams. It you know, perhaps some of the motivation might go out of India. It also enables England to stay on the attack and have attacking fields and not worry that they might be leaving the door open for India to win. That doesn't mean that it's the right thing to do, but I do just wish that, you know, your Warnes and your Vaughans would at least sort of acknowledge the fact that it's perfectly reasonable to do that. They just think it's the wrong tactic, but they're just so kind of like baffled and, sort of borderline angry.
Yeah, there's the number of factors at play are many. Yeah, you know, obviously India have just come off the back of an unbelievable fourth innings chase in Australia. In home conditions with a batting lineup that has a real nice mix of diggers and whatever the opposite is, the diggers. Yeah, exactly. With the patience to stick it out until the end, potentially, and the kind of firepower to accelerate if needed. So, yeah, it was clearly the right decision in the end, or it was played to perfection.
They won the game.
Exactly. I guess there was an element of that passage of play as England's second innings kind of limped to a finish. Yeah, it wasn't the best kind of hour of cricket or 45 minutes of cricket. So Don Best just for padding away, and
yeah,
it was a bit scrappy. The people were possibly understandably a little bit mildly disappointed at the time that England hadn't kind of carried the momentum into the fourth innings in a way that maybe they looked like they might have.
Yeah, but I think that's it though. I think they were bored. Because it wasn't the best spectacle, and it is a bit of a problem in cricket. There's not really much you can do about it, but I've heard Nasser make this point a few times that, and I agree that it's one of the only sort of scenarios in Test cricket that is just quite boring is that setting a target in the third innings of the game when one team is a long way ahead after first innings, and inevitably they are going to set a target. It's going to be around about that 400 mark, whatever it might be. But it's just a bit of it's kind of going through the motions. It's a bit of a slog to get to that point. So it's not the most exciting passage in Test cricket because you just want to get into that fourth innings and see what happens. So it's a bit sort of frustrating as a viewer. But that's not Joe Root's fault or the England team's fault. The commentators or your Warnes and your Vaughans are basically just going like, oh, just fucking declare. But it's like from Joe Root's point of view, he wants to make sure he wins the game, and he doesn't really care at that point whether you're sort of super entertained or not. It was obviously the right decision because they won the game. But it could have been the wrong decision. But I do just wish that in the discourse about it, it was sort of like there was some acknowledgement of the fact that it is quite complicated. It's not as straightforward as just declare. Because as we're going to talk about in a bit, literally on that day West Indies chased down 395. Those sorts of targets are not always out of reach in Test cricket anymore. Maybe on that pitch in Chennai it was, but yeah, it's not as straightforward as Shane and Michael would have you believe.
Yeah, quite. And Joe Root in his post-match comments said he had spent more time on that pitch than anyone else in the Test match, and that was what he felt. And the fact that England wrapped up victory so comprehensively bears him out.
Yeah. What about India then? How do you think they will reflect on this game after the ecstasy of their result in Australia? They're back down to earth with a bit of a bump. Will they write this off as a bit of a hangover, or do you think they have reasons to be worried for the rest of the series?
Yeah, clearly they're a team that expects to win when they play at home, and it expects to be at the very top of the game. So, undoubtedly they'll be very disappointed, won't they? But I don't know. Three more tests to go. I think it could still go either way. I don't think it changes a huge amount about the balance of the sides, does it? You could argue they were a little bit unfortunate in a couple of moments. A couple of the catches that England took were fortunate. One coming off Pope's shoulder.
Yeah.
So obviously it was a very comprehensive win, but they'll feel well in the series still. There's a long way to go.
Yeah, obviously they lost the toss here as well, and if they win the toss in the next one and bat first, they'll still be backing themselves to post a big total and put England under pressure. So yeah, I don't think it's. I don't think there's any reason for panic stations for India at all. But they will be perhaps, just mildly concerned by the scale of the defeat and the fact they were so comprehensively outplayed, because that they just wouldn't have been expecting England to be capable of that in their own conditions, I wouldn't have thought. And there wasn't... Like, do you remember we used to talk about there was... There used to be a show on Indian TV. It may still exist, I don't know. But certainly 10, 12 years ago, it did. A show called Who Is to Blame? That would come out, whenever India lost a Test match, this programme would come on, Who Is to Blame? And they'd try and pinpoint who was at fault for the defeat. So I don't know if that is still on, but I don't think you can blame any one person, because they were just the whole performance, they were just miles behind England, weren't they? There was no one really had a particularly good game. Well, maybe Ashwin, I suppose, did take wickets in the second innings, but aside from that, there's no one that you think, like, well, they had a really good game and were just let down by their teammates. It just, you know, they were just a long, long way away. But yeah, still three tests to play. I still think they're going to be confident of winning the series from here, and it's set up beautifully, isn't it? My prediction, my pre-series prediction, we obviously didn't do a pod pre-series, but it would have been 3-1 to India. So that is still possible, still very possible. You know, surely India will play better at some point. We saw no runs or hardly any runs in this game from that kind of engine room of Pujara, Kohli, Rahane. You've got to imagine there's going to be runs coming from there at some point. So, as I say, I think they'll still fancy their chances. But what do you think, Tane? How do you see the rest of the series playing out from here?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, yeah, you know, Kohli was batting very, very well until he got out in the second innings. You know, what did he make? 72 off 104. Got a ball from Stokes, which didn't get up much. So it's, you know, probably a touch unfortunate there. Clearly they're going to be very dangerous. I think the flip side for England is that, you know, Root in this kind of form is a phenomenal platform to build a winning, a series winning team around. I'm just going to give you some names here. Ben Stokes at the top of the order. You know, Burns didn't do an awful lot here, but, you know, clearly someone who's looked the part, you know, in the last year or so for England. Sibley, you know, there's the building blocks are there for England to do better perhaps than we thought maybe a couple of weeks ago before they've started winning.
Well, aside from the results, Tane, the most noteworthy thing about this game is the fact that it was on free-to-air TV in the UK, back on Channel 4. So it's the first test on free-to-air in the UK for 16 years since it left Channel 4 after the 2005 Ashes.
I mean, that is just, like, intoxicating, really.
What,
is
nostalgia.
I felt lightheaded after watching it. But yeah, they've been finishing the output with a montage of the day's play set to Mamba number 5.
A little bit of Jessica in my life. What have you made of the coverage?
Oh, it's fine, isn't it? I mean, the coverage itself, you know, the studio setup, the, you know, obviously Sir Cookie in there. You know, it is what it is, isn't it? They've obviously sort of put it together at very short notice, and clearly, yeah, the coverage they're taking from India, from the India broadcaster, it's a pretty wonderful thing, isn't it? It's a real kind of unexpected bonus to see what is a pretty massive series, and, you know, a huge series, on free to air is pretty awesome. I mean.
Well, especially in lockdown when you know that so many people are at home.
Yeah.
Be able to watch it.
And I think the viewership, it's been sort of peaking at 1.5 million, 1.8 million, I think, according to Channel 4, which is pretty good. And that would be many more eyeballs than would be on it if it was on Sky, as good as the coverage is on Sky. It is. It's a pretty awesome thing. I've read a couple of articles today, talking about the potential impact. I think it's pretty hard to gauge. You know, if you're a sort of sub casual cricket fan, or you've never seen the sport before, you've never watched it on TV. As wonderful as a lot of the performances were to diehard cricket fans or interested parties, is Don Best padding it away? Is that going to suck? You know, people are going to be. I don't know. I think possibly the impact will be overstated by people slightly.
Yeah, well, it won't be the same as, like, the fact that, you know, when the 2019 World Cup final was on.
Yeah, exactly.
On Channel 4. That is just a much easier, much more accessible thing, isn't it? But, you know, and that we've always known that the shorter formats are the accessible formats. I wouldn't be too disheartened if the viewing figures aren't that amazing. I mean, it sounds like they're pretty decent, but, you know, because I think. Well, I don't know if disheartened might be the wrong word, but I don't think we should set too much store by it, in the sense that I don't think it can be like the be all and end all just having this one series on Channel 4. Like, I don't think that's enough. it has to be a gradual process, doesn't it? People aren't, it's probably a stretch or unrealistic to think that someone will just flick on Channel 4, watch 10 minutes of Test cricket and be hooked for life. Like, that's just not really how it works. It needs to be just like part of the kind of national culture, the national conversation. And that's what happens when it's on television that people can watch. Whereas when it's on Sky, it's only people who are already into it who are going to seek it out. So yeah, it can't just be one series. It needs to be an ongoing thing. And that doesn't necessarily mean that every match and every series has to be on free to air. They need to figure out a way of getting certain key events, certain key matches, key series, whether it's, you know, a couple of tests a summer or something like that, that's shared between Channel 4 and Sky, that it just becomes a kind of rolling thing, that cricket is back in the back on people's horizons in a way that it hasn't been for 15 years. I don't think one series is going to do it, you know, one series of where the coverage starts at 4 a.m. and stops at 11, like that's not going to be enough, is it? But it's a great start, and I do find it genuinely exciting that it's happening. I mean, the coverage itself, as you say, you can't fault it because they put it together so quickly, but it isn't a patch on Sky's, is it? But then it never could be. I do think they need a third person in the studio. Cookie's having to do a lot of work, isn't he?
Yeah.
A lot of heavy lifting. I also think that they need to stop reading out tweets. Like, I don't care about what people are saying on Twitter. I suppose you could possibly level this criticism at our podcast. But yeah, you know, if I want to know what people are saying on Twitter, I'll look at Twitter, which I am. So yeah, don't tell me what people are saying on Twitter. Just get Alistair Cook to give another kind of panicked opinion. And also,
He comes out with some great turns of phrase as well, by the way.
He does, actually, yeah.
What did he say this morning about, so like a blind squirrel finds the nut or something?
I had the subtitles on at that point because I was giving Teddy a bottle and I just looked up at the screen. And obviously, because it's live, the subtitles are like about 10 seconds behind. And I kind of looked up and just written on the screen was, "Even a blind squirrel finds a nut." And I was like, what? I suddenly turned on Spring Watch or something. It was very strange.
Yeah, it's cracking.
But yeah, I also think, I do think that Atherton and Hussain are a big miss. I feel like it should be a rule that Atherton and Hussain have to commentate on every game of cricket being played anywhere in the world.
How are you finding Nick Knight?
I don't mind Nick Knight these days. I've grown rather fond of Nick Knight. I do find some of the Indian commentary a little tiresome. I think I said to you that I was watching a bit where in the middle of Pant's innings, kind of cameo in the first innings, we just played a forward defensive and one of the commentators went, "Oh, brilliant from Rishabh." It's like, I mean, I do get really frustrated with it. You know, commentators are guilty of it all over the world, certainly in England. You know, the kind of like Stokes root loving that you get from a lot of English commentators, I find annoying. I'm sure people from other countries must find that really annoying. It certainly happens in Australia. But in the case of the Indian commentators, I haven't actually seen them because they obviously cut back, as we say, to Cookie in the studio. But apparently they're wearing Team India branded clothing, the commentators. So yeah, it's when they're actually on the payroll, it's maybe a little it's even harder to stomach, I think, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, interesting.
Cheerleading.
I think you make a good point about it. You know, it's only a start, isn't it? And it's got to be there's got to be some consistency to it, as you say, to make it as part of the national conversation. But you know, there is sort of promising signs, aren't there? The fact that the 2019 World Cup final went to Channel 4 was amazing at the time, and clearly as an occasion it delivered in a ludicrous way. And then you've got this, and obviously BBC are going to be showing the 100, which, you know, is clearly very divisive to long-time cricket fans, but it's something, at least, whether the intentions are right, I don't know, but there are some promising signs there. And the fact that, I think I'm right saying, obviously Channel 4 have got the 4 test series, but also the 5 T20s and the ODIs afterwards as well, so yeah, there's going to be cricket on Channel 4 for the next, you know, 6 weeks at least. Yeah, it's a decent amount of time. We're not talking about like a two-test series in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, that's definitely promising for sure.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
All right, well, we're rabbiting on a bit here, Tone. So let's move on and let's cross over to Chittagong, where a truly extraordinary test match took place this week between the home side Bangladesh and West Indies. The first test of their two-test series, Bangladesh making 430 in the first innings with a maiden test 100 from Mehdi Hasan Miraz. So that was an imposing first inning score, and it looked even more imposing when West Indies were bowled out in their reply for 259 with Mehdi Hasan taking four wickets. Bangladesh then declared on 223 for eight in the third innings of the game with the captain Momenul Haq making a century. And that set West Indies an extremely imposing target of 395. And it looked a very, very long way away when they were 59 for three. But then a partnership between Nkrumah Bonner, debutant from Jamaica, and Kyle Mayers, debutant from Barbados, they put on 216 for the fourth wicket before Bonner was removed by Tijal Islam with the score on 275. So still a ways away from the target, but Kyle Mayers kept going, and he was joined by Joshua Da Silva for another excellent partnership that meant, against all the odds, West Indies got to that target of 395 with three wickets remaining. Mayers finished unbeaten on 210, a double hundred in the fourth innings on debut. So this was, Tone, the biggest ever successful run chase in Asia and the fifth biggest successful run chase anywhere. So how about it? I mean, after India's record-breaking win in Brisbane the other week, we've now had this, two of the best test matches you'll ever see, or certainly two of the best fourth innings run chases you'll ever see, in the space of a couple of weeks. As you said earlier, cricket is on fire.
This is absolutely astonishing, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, I don't know, Mayer's innings right there, it must be up there with, to put it into your words, it's one of the great test innings, surely. Impossible to predict that. I know obviously he came in as a debutant. Yeah, he had a bit of first class form behind him. And I know, reading some of the Caribbean Cricket Observers, it's not a surprise that he's cut out or that he's got it, got the equipment for, or he's got the game for, he's got the equipment.
He's got a bat, he's got an arm guard, he's got a box.
He's got the game for test cricket, but I mean, yeah, exactly. You couldn't have expected that. You know, the context of the team, the fact that, what was it, about 11 first choice regulars, or 10 first choice regulars, had opted not to travel for the series. So you had, three debutants. Yeah, just a wonderful story, and just an astonishing knock, isn't it? Well, he finished 210, 24s, 7 sixes along there. I suppose Bonner, shouldn't forget Bonner, he faced 245 balls alongside him. In the face of obviously, is it a cliche to call them an ever-improving Bangladesh side? With some serious weapons, so yeah, they're astonishing.
Well, yeah, I suppose, because on the face of it, like some people, if they are just tuning back into Channel 4 or you know, maybe haven't paid sort of super close attention to Test cricket over the last 10 years, yeah, you might think, oh well, it's Bangladesh, but actually, you know, while you know, comparing it to that India win at Brisbane, what you know, winning in Bangladesh isn't quite like winning Australia in terms of difficulty, improbability, but it is a very tough place to go, and both England and Australia have come a cropper there in recent years. West Indies lost 2-0 on their last trip a couple of years ago, and that was with a full strength team. As you say, they were missing a raft of key players for a variety of reasons, including the captain, Jason Holder, also Darren Bravo, Shimron Hetmyer, Shamar Brooks, Roston Chase, Shane Dowrich. 3 to 5 in the batting order were all debutants. Joshua De Silva, the wicketkeeper, was playing his second test. So this is a very inexperienced team versus Bangladesh, who actually have some of the most experienced cricketers in the world. You know, looking at that team, Tamim Iqbal, Mushfiqur Rahim has been around since 2005, I think he made his debut. Shakib Al Hassan was playing this game too. Yeah, it is actually a very experienced Bangladesh team. And then West Indies, you know, even when they are at full strength, they don't win away from home very much at all. So barring Zimbabwe and Afghanistan, they haven't won a series away from home since they toured Bangladesh 8 years ago, when Bangladesh weren't as good as they are now. So if you don't include Afghanistan, Zimbabwe or Bangladesh, you've got to go back to February 1995 for the last time West Indies won a series away from home against anyone else. That was against New Zealand. So if they do win this series, it will be an extremely rare thing. And then also, you know, they were actually a long, long way behind in this game as well. A lot of people are saying, you know, that this might be one of West Indies' best test victories ever. Again, it's that the key thing there being one of. I checked it out. It's their 176th victory in Test, but I think it must be one of the best, just in terms of all of that context, all of those disadvantages that they had in terms of players missing and stuff. The unlikelihood of it means that it has to be up there, I think.
Yeah, it just has to be, doesn't it? And I watched the highlights of Mayer's innings, and yeah, there were a few streaky moments, but. Yeah, it's clearly an astonishing effort. And what's quite nice, you know, obviously these debutants, they're not kids. These are slightly more experienced players at say, domestic level, you know, sort of 26, 27, 28.
Yeah, Mayers is 28, Bonner's 32, I think.
Yeah. So that's just really nice, you know, as nice as it is to see, you know, an 18-year-old, a 19-year-old, a 20-year-old come in and you know, play a match-winning, or put in a match-winning performance, you know, For a whole batch of internationally inexperienced players, but players who have been around for a while, so to get that kind of reward is awesome, and obviously a special moment for Barbados, Ezra Mosey dying, you know, over the last few days, and for a Barbadian in Mayers to come through and produce that is it's pretty rousing.
It was, as you say, just a staggering innings and a staggering achievement. The list of players who've made double hundreds in successful fourth innings run chases goes Gordon Greenidge in 1984, Kyle Mayers on Sunday, and that's it. Gordon Greenidge, another Bayesian, of course. Although, astonishingly, Tone, it is not even the biggest score by a debutant in Chittagong. Jacques Rudolph made 222 not out in 2003. So there's always a stat in cricket, isn't there? But yeah, I mean, I don't know if you want to have this conversation, but where does it rank? You know, you mentioned, it, like, is it one of the great test innings of all time? We've obviously talked about Ben Stokes at Headingley, Kusal Pereira a couple of years ago. I don't know if it's quite up there with those in terms of either the quality of the attack or the context, if only because it was the ground was empty. You know, it does maybe take something or will take something away when people look back in years to come. But then given it was on debut, it probably has to be up there, doesn't it?
It's hard. And yeah, match situation, yeah, what, as you say, the target was 395. He came to the crease with West Indies 59 for 3. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you talk about, obviously, yeah, Mayers here, Stokes, Pereira, all fourth innings chases, and there is a unique set of challenges, obviously, that, you know, that face a batsman in that situation, particularly when, you know, defeat is much closer than victory, and those kind of innings obviously really capture the imagination. But it, I don't know, you, it, just to play devil's advocate, you know, are these innings where really there's only one option and it is to kind of play with some boldness and take a few chances as these guys, or those three innings all kind of demonstrated? Or is it the first innings century where facing fresh bowlers with a new ball and I don't know, you know, so we always remember the fourth innings traces.
Yeah, that's a good point. I suppose, you know, in most cases, batting conditions are easier in the first innings than they are in the fourth innings. But, yeah, I suppose mentally, it's probably mentally a bit more straightforward in the fourth innings that you know what you've got to do. It is probably just as you say that they tend to be the memorable ones. They tend to be the ones that stick out because they quite literally won the game, whereas the match-winning knock in the first innings, well, it might have been match-winning, but a whole lot more cricket had to be played after that in order to kind of carry it through.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, yeah, just compare like Joe Root's to, what did he make, 218?
Mm-hmm.
To that, I don't know. Yeah, just it's a conversation starter.
It's a nice breaker, really, isn't it? It's a nice breaker.
Yeah, exactly. We should kind of, I don't know, create a Royal Cricket Show range of crackers with little conversation starters in for next Christmas.
All right, well played West Indies anyway. Just an absolutely marvellous win. And as you say, Tane, just some really great Test cricket happening at the moment. Well, finally then, let's also just quickly mention Pakistan's series victory over South Africa. They won the first test in Karachi by 7 wickets. It was a bit of a fluctuating game, that one. South Africa were well in it, having made 220 in their first innings, when they had Pakistan 27 for 4 and then 176 for 6 in their reply. But Pakistan eventually took quite a big first innings lead and only set a target of 88 to chase. And then the second test, again, South Africa were well in the game at various points, including in the fourth innings, chasing 370, another mammoth target. But they were 241 for 3, with Aidan Markram making a century and Themba Bavuma 61 not out. But they lost their last 7 wickets for 33 runs to be bowled out for 274. So Pakistan wrapping up the series with a 95-run victory. Did you watch much of this, Tane? I watched a huge amount of the first test. Obviously, as you mentioned, we're in lockdown. It's quite nice to have all this test cricket on. Less so the second test, only because India-England was on at the same time. But, you know, it is on TV in the UK. It's on Sky. And it's, I thought it was an enjoyable series.
Yeah, I agree. It was awesome to see Fawad Alam scoring that century in the first test. On his home ground, 35 years old. What, he's only played 9 tests, and you know, as a very, very decent first class average. So you know, sort of a player who's kind of somewhat gone to waste, really, for Pakistan. So that was a pretty special moment. And then Naomin Ali, at 34 on debut, taking a fifer as well. I thought it was awesome.
At 34, going on
at my age,
going on 49. he looked a lot older than 34, I have to say. But yeah, I do enjoy a sort of very old Pakistani debutant. Always good to see. But Pakistan are so erratic. If you cast your mind back to that series in England last summer, we were singing their praises at some points, even though they lost that series, and then they went and got obliterated in New Zealand. But actually, two of the players we were most effusive about in England, Shaan Masood and Mohammad Abbas, have both now been dropped. So Shaan Masood scored that brilliant 100 in the first test in England. After that, he scored 33 runs in 8 innings, including 4 ducks. And Mohammad Abbas, who, you know, has been like one of the best bowlers in the world over the last few years, only managed 4 wickets in New Zealand and was cast aside. So they're a strange team a difficult team to kind of get a handle on in some ways. But they were pretty impressive here. It's good to see Hassan Ali back in the fold. He took 5 wickets to wrap up the series on the final day. And as you mentioned, I wanted to talk about the fact, you know, it's just so great to have Test cricket back in Pakistan. So obviously we had a decade or more where they were playing in the UAE, but they are finally now back playing fixtures on home soil. Sri Lanka and Bangladesh have both been in the last 18 months now. South Africa, England, New Zealand and Australia are all slated to tour in the next couple of years. And yeah, it is remarkable that, you know, until, what, a year or so ago when Sri Lanka and Bangladesh turned up, none of their team had ever played in Pakistan before, had ever played Test cricket in Pakistan before. Even Azhar Ali, who's 35 years old and has been around forever, you know, that was his first Test match at home. And I just wonder if it's a sort of underappreciated fact, you know, that they just haven't played Test cricket at home, that they have this massive disadvantage. And they actually got to number one in the world a couple of years back without playing even a single game at home. I mean, I know, you know, I suppose you can overdo that because they were playing in the UAE and they did turn that into a bit of a fortress. They had a really good record there. It was a horrible place to play for other teams. It was a horrible place to tour. So they did have that advantage, but they weren't playing in front of their home fans, which obviously no one's doing at the moment. But still, I just wonder if, you know, we sort of have taken it a bit for granted that they've been a very competitive Test team without playing at home.
Yeah, that's probably a good point. Yeah, as you say, they found a suitable home in the UAE. It helped them get the best out of themselves. Certainly, it wasn't like they sort of, you know, decamped in Scotland or something. So, but yeah, no, I think it's a fair point. You know, obviously, you know, clearly not an easy time, kind of all round to build any kind of sort of pathway into a national team if you can't play in front of, you know, a home crowd. So yeah, I think you're totally right. And just, you know, for cricket as a whole, for Test cricket, just a massive step in the right direction, and long may it continue.
Definitely. And I'd say it's on the schedule that the England, New Zealand and Australia will be going there, and I hope they do. Obviously those security concerns haven't gone away, but they must be more confident of being able to control that, otherwise it wouldn't be happening, it wouldn't be in the diary. So yeah, and hopefully it won't be too long before fans can come back in too, because, you know, Karachi, Rawalpindi would normally be amazing atmospheres. I mean, I found it quite, I was going to say emotional, but that's probably that's probably too strong a word. But, you know, it did, I suddenly realised, I was like, oh yeah, I haven't watched Test cricket in Pakistan for a very, very long time. And it's one of the great locations, one of the great sort of places, part of that sort of beating heart of Test cricket, isn't it? And Sky were showing, because they didn't really have a studio set up, they didn't have sort of an anchor, you know, pundits discussing it. They would just lunch interval or the tea interval, they wouldn't do any analysis, they'd just show highlights of old matches and then they'd go back to the live action. So they were showing a lot of highlights of past games in Pakistan, and it is, yeah, it's just great stuff. Although that being said, what they were mainly showing was England failing to chase, you know, England losing in Multan in 2005, failing to chase 198. It was that first Test match after the Ashes in 2005, which England had 198 to win and threw it away. And I have very much still not come to terms with that. So that was a bit of a kick in the teeth at 7 in the morning to watch that on repeat. All right, well, that's going to be it, I think, for the World Cricket Show this time. Have you enjoyed this one, Tone?
Yeah, it's been good.
Hopefully the technology has seen us through here. What time are you due for a landing? Has air traffic control given you clearance yet?
Straight into Flight Simulator, I think.
What have you got lined up, Tone, to keep you busy in lockdown?
Good question. Well, a bit more cricket. Having said all that about, you know, Test cricket absolutely flying at the moment, there's not a huge amount more Test cricket to come sort of around the world, is there, over the next few months? And Well, that'll get us through to the end of this month at least.
Is the IPL happening again? They're not doing it in April, are they?
Yeah, no, it is, because obviously Joss Butler is off, isn't he?
Is it? Yeah, of course. April and May 2021. Tedious. Well, at least we've got three more tests in this India series to keep us busy. All right, well, we'll be back after that second test in China. It's a day-nighter, isn't it? The next one?
That's the third test.
That's the third test, okay.
Yeah, I mean, that is just heady stuff, isn't it? That is absolutely remarkable.
What, 9 a.m. start?
9 a.m. start, I mean.
What date is that test then?
That is the 24th. So it starts on a Wednesday.
Fingers crossed we're still in lockdown.
Yeah, no, don't say that.
Come on, the lockdown.
To be fair, that would be absolutely ideal. Just come out of lockdown on that Monday the 29th. I don't know, there isn't 29 days this year, is there? Monday the 1st of March.
Yeah. If Deputy Peter Fairbrush is listening, could he work that into the exit from lockdown framework? All right, well, yeah, we will be back to review the remainder of this series. But in the meantime, if you enjoy the World Cricket Show, do get involved on Twitter. It's our favourite place. We're at Cricket Show. We tweet loads from there. You can also like us on Facebook. That's also at Cricket Show. You can follow us on Instagram at World Cricket Show. You can send us an email, worldcricketshow@gmail.com. And if you do enjoy the show, then why not leave us a rating and or a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this, because that does help to bring new people to the show. So thank you very much to everyone who has been doing that. But that, Tone, is it, I think. I'm going to go to bed now. It's absolutely freezing here tonight. I don't know if you can see, I've been huddled under a blanket like an old man. Got a blanket over my knees.
It is chilly, isn't it? I not to just moan again at stuff, but it really annoyed me that, obviously there's a bit of snow around, but it was being billed as Beast from the East 2 on the news.
Yeah.
I was like, for God's sake, snow didn't start with Beast from the East. Just really annoying. I think I'm really becoming much more bitter and curmudgeonly as I get older.
Yeah, and you weren't starting from a great place in that respect. No, exactly. I have to say. Yeah, well, I'm still furious about motorbikes. So, yeah, it's not a good, not a good combo, really, is it? Anyway, let's bring it to an end there. Stay in school, everyone. Keep up the homeschooling, and we'll talk to you soon. Cheers, Tone. Bye bye for now.
Cheers. I can smell your fear. Ba da da ba ba, 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 ba da da ba ba.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.